Welcome to Policy Speaking, a podcast that checks in every week with the people at the center of the debates about where Canadian policy should be headed, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. We speak with the thinkers, doers, and deciders about how good policy can make for a better Canada. We'll be putting out a new episode every Thursday, so please join us weekly if you're up for a deep dive into the policy choices in front of us and the trade-offs involved. Here's the host of Policy Speaking, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum and former Editor-in-Chief of the Globe and Mail.
Thanks for tuning in. I am not Edward Greenspan, but you all know me. I'm Katie Davey, the executive producer of Policy Speaking. Later in the episode, we will be joined by Jerry Diaz, the national president of Unifor, and Ed will be back to take you through that interview. The interview itself took place on June 22nd at our third and final Brave New Work conference. If you've been following along here at Policy Speaking over the last 3 weeks, you'll be familiar with some of the topics that we'll dig into later. Das Bednar, the PPF Fellow and guest host of Policy Speaking over the last 3 weeks, is actually back here to join us again today to help us recap the conversations that she's been having and the conference that we just referenced. Welcome, Bass.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me back. Thanks for keeping me around.
Yeah, well, no, it's a pleasure. I think, you know, you really piqued our interest in the really cool topics that you covered and brought to life over the last 3 weeks. So, you know, thrilled that you were able to do that with us and thrilled that you were able to participate in the Brave New Work conference itself. Let me actually start there. What was your biggest takeaway from the two-day conference itself?
You know, what really surprised and impressed me is that it wasn't a speculative conversation. It was very data-driven. It was very rooted in trends that are already observable. And in the spirit of policy makers, policy people, engaged citizens, relevant stakeholders, wanting to be as useful and productive in the moment. And I think that's really part of the messy middleness, you know, to kind of pick up on that narrative that you have. Responding to the future of work is an iterative and highly collaborative engagement. And that was kind of, that whole spirit was kind of perfectly captured in the 2 days of the Brave New Work conference.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because as you kind of say, you use the word speculative. And I think for a lot of people who have been loosely following this future of work conversation, it has been speculative over the last, you know, decade or even longer, as folks kind of say, you know, we're going to see massive automation, we're going to see X, Y, Z. But to your point, we're seeing the data and we're seeing what the trends actually are unfolding and how they might continue to unfold. And, you know, I think as we wrap up this 3-year project focused on the future of work, I think it's very evident that the conversation is continuing to evolve. So, you know, where do you see this conversation going in the next, I don't know, month or year or 3 years?
Next month, the next moment. Yeah. One area that I think we're going to get to very quickly is around proportionality and surveillance when it comes to work. Right now, we don't have a lot of guidelines in that regard. And we're seeing, as people work from home more often, or maybe forever now, interesting interventions from the workplace that challenge the, I think, employment relationship, just tracking your keystrokes, being able to turn on your webcam, taking random screenshots. And not only is that invasive and stressful for workers, but it also kind of reduces, you know, work to particular motions. So I'd like to see us have a bigger and broader conversation about that, that can also just help us recognize that, you know, undue surveillance has become a key facet of low-wage retail and service work in Canada for quite some time. The policy making, I'll say, class cohort is very much divorced from that. But through the pandemic, I think there's been more experiences and exposure. So yeah, surveillance is definitely one. And a second, of course, riffing from the most recent episode of Policy Speaking, more alternate kind of complementary novel data sets being incorporated as we identify our priorities, but also start to, you know, look for new indicators to evaluate how we're doing with policy interventions. And that could come from places like FreshBook, GoFundMe, Visa, MasterCard, and many more, maybe even other Canadian companies like Shopify helping us understand the dynamics of entrepreneurship in this country.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? Like, as you kind of said off the top with the conference this year, it was very data-driven and folks were intervening through data and presenting data. But I think what we've also found during this pandemic on almost every topic, there's still a massive data gap in this country and kind of in the policymaking space. And, you know, perhaps as you say, the data might exist, but it just might be in places that we're not used to looking. And also though, that data could present a more fulsome picture to actually create more fulsome policy conversations, really. So what, you know, what would your advice be to policymakers? Like, how do policymakers respond to this fast moving conversation? And again, this very dynamic environment?
I mean, I always like to start with refining the tool set that we have. And I know that there's great work both federally and provincially looking at understanding gig work. We know that social assistance modernization is, you know, complex and thorny file for sure, but we know that it's top of mind for Canadian policymakers. I think those are really productive interventions. And, you know, really rethinking the post-secondary space. It is fascinating how resilient post-secondary has been to change over time, even with digitization and acceleration. And I think in a lot of ways, we're shy to challenge the kind of, you know, comfort and familiarity of the ivory tower. But let's face it, we have more part-time students than ever before, more mature students, and people are seeking different things, as Harvey Weingarten was pointing to, you know, particular, targeted, and emergent skill sets, right? People might be going back to school to earn a micro-credential or demonstrate a new kind of knowledge that didn't even previously exist before. So when we point to the responsiveness as policymakers, I think we need to expect that same kind of responsiveness, experimentation, innovation from our learning institutions and, you know, relinquish some of that fear that, you know, that kind of evolution compromises the quality of that place. I guess ivory tower is kind of a slur, but it's kind of a fancy word too. Let's just say post-secondary instead of that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, thanks so much for that. And for folks who are intrigued by, you know, the paper Vass just mentioned, you can find all of the work that led up to this conference on our website at pbforum.ca. Also, if you're just tuning in and hearing about Vass's three episodes for the first time, they're in our back catalog. So the last three episodes are on these exact topics. So please do feel free to check those out. And with that, we'll head over into our interview. Thank you so much, Vass.
Thank you. See ya.
Bye. Before we get into the interview between Ed and Jerry, I just wanted to let folks know that this is actually the last episode that we'll be releasing before we meet again in September. So when we do come back, we'll actually be pivoting slightly away from being squarely focused on the impacts of COVID-19 like we have been over the last 15 or so months, but we'll still be joined by the top doers, thinkers, and deciders to help us navigate this change that we're experiencing. In the meantime, though, we'll be resharing our top 10 episodes over the summer months. So do follow along on social media to catch up on any episodes you may have missed. And with that, I'm pleased to welcome both Edward Greenspan and Jerry Diaz, the national president of Unifor. Over to you, Ed.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us to share your insights, polish off that webcam. Maybe you'll share some hopes and dreams about the future of work. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here, Vass. Thank you very much. And hello, Ed. How are you today?
Very, very good. Great to see you and looking forward to a robust discussion. Robust is one of the most overused words of the early 21st century, I think. So lively. I'm looking for lively. Jerry, look, a few minutes I want to talk about the auto industry, which is one of the original industries of Unifor, which of course is the product of a merger some years back now. And I want to talk very particularly about EVs. But for starters, because your union is so broad and because you're in manufacturing, in services, in resources, it gives you sight lines into a lot of sectors as we're coming out of this pandemic. And I'm just wondering, what the recovery is looking like from you and what lessons you might be drawing about the future of work as you're watching all these different sectors.
Well, there's no question the pandemic had a huge impact on our organization, just like it did across union and businesses globally. At one time, we had, out of our 315,000 members, we had over 100,000 people, 100,000 members on layoff during the pandemic. So right now, we'll probably have about 35, 40,000 members on layoff. You know, really, members in the airline industry, in the service sector, our members that work in casinos, hotels, we can walk right through the list. So in my opinion, the future, look, it's pretty bleak in certain industries. Like I couldn't even predict how many years it'll take for the airline sector to get back to where it was pre-pandemic. How many years is it going to take for people to feel comfortable traveling? What's the hotel industry going to look like? How often, when will people feel comfortable going back into casinos? So I'm talking about some of our members that have been negatively impacted. But I think what the pandemic has also done, Ed, it really has shown us, you know, who the essential workers really are, who the most important workers really are. And I think it shows the discrepancy. And I think it has also exposed the lack of respect that the workers we depend on day in, day out get on a regular basis. I think about their economy. I think about their wages. I think about how they've been left behind, how they've been taken advantage of. And so I'm thinking and I'm talking about our members that work in long-term care facilities that are making a little above minimum wage, who have been destined to precarious part-time, non-standard jobs. And we saw what happened as our members in long-term care facilities had to have 2-3 jobs in order to make ends meet, transferred COVID from one long-term facilities to another long-term facilities to another long-term. And what have we done about it? Nothing. I think about our members in grocery stores. I can walk through the list, so fire away.
I was just going to actually make a reference to grocery stores because I actually used to work in a grocery store through high school, and grocery store clerks became heroic figures, as you say, essential service workers through this. I wonder two things about that. I wonder if you think that has staying power, that kind of social respect that was gained. And secondly, I want to talk about technological change, because even grocery store clerks are subject, and I want to talk this more broadly as well, but you know, we're seeing a lot of changes in the industry and digitalized changes that have been amplified and accelerated by this. So how concerned are you that, well, the technological change is really the, you know, the big issue for you?
Okay, well, first of all, let me start with the grocery stores and then get to the whole issue of tech change. Look, I remember, like I'm 62 years old, I remember when I was younger, I remember as a teenager, as a young adult, that grocery store jobs were good middle-class jobs, good working class. I mean, they were paid well, respected, and then over time with the introduction of the discount stores and frankly, with the manifestation of complete greed from the Loblaws, the Sobeys, the Metro stores, wages dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. And it drives me crazy when I see like the Weston family under sitting on $8 billion worth of wealth, cutting pandemic pay from their employees that have made them even more profits during the pandemic than the years before. So that's okay. Let me get off my soapbox in that regard before this discussion starts to get very off key as it relates to greed. But I'm not afraid of technology at all, which I think will probably surprise a lot of people, because there's this mindset that unions live in the past, that we're Neanderthals, that we just can't get with the changing times. And I argue just the opposite. I'm very concerned if companies don't invest in new technology. So to me, I'm more afraid of what happens if you don't play, as opposed to the impact that it'll have on jobs, because I will argue that yes, jobs will be negatively impacted in some regards, but also leads to the creation of other jobs. So, you know, we've been dealing with technology forever. I think about the auto industry, you go all the way back to the introduction of the assembly line. So we've been dealing with new technologies and the impact that it has on working class people is not new. But what we have to make sure of is that working class people are a part of the discussion so that working people can be brought along with the changes, to be trained with the implementation of a new technology. So it really has to be a broad-based discussion between all levels of governments, the corporate community, the labor movement, with workers being, in my opinion, the center of the discussion, because without working people, there's not going to be 1 cent of profit made anywhere.
Yeah, you know, we've done some work together, Unifor and PPF, around the newspaper industry, and PPF is also very active in the energy industry transition discussion. You know, those industries are changing. I mean, there's just, you know, no way that the status quo holds there. So it's interesting to hear that you're not the proponent of the status quo. Does that make you the proponent of a term that some people use that sort of I find a little off-putting, but, you know, the just transition?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because just transition means a variety of different things. If I'm a worker in the oil and energy industry, if I'm working in Fort McMurray for Suncor, when I hear the term just transition, I view it as I'm losing my job. Yeah. As opposed to what does it mean? Does it mean that we're going to have the conversation about what happens with the eventuality of a changing economy? If we believe that climate change is a real issue, which I do, and I also believe that it's the issue for the generation, then we better start having a conversation about what's going to happen with the transformation from fossil fuels to clean electricity. So just transition can't just be a catchy phrase that, you know, scares the hell out of people. It has to be the starting of the dialogue as to what does it really mean. So if we are conscious of what we have done to the world and the harm that we inflicted upon it, and we believe that climate change is an issue, which it is, well, then what are we going to do? How are we going to transition? What are the jobs that are going to be for a greener economy? How do we start to transition it? How do we start talking to our members, workers in industries that we know, frankly, are in long-term peril?
I want to go right down that point. I will say, because I said I found just transition off-putting, I think I should explain. I find it off-putting because it's easy to say just transition if you're not the person going through the transition. And it could be, as you just said, Jerry, it could be a substitute for action. Slogans are not policy. So that's problematic. But I want to go down the point that you're raising right now, because I was watching during the pandemic, I was watching television and not only Netflix, and I was watching a documentary on CBC called Company Town, and it was about GM's decision to close the plant in Oshawa. And I recognize, and perhaps we'll talk about it later, that there's new action in Oshawa, which is, you know, great for your workers, obviously. But that plant looms very big in the Canadian imagination. And it featured in our first BNW, first Brave New Work conference, actually. So I want to play one clip now. I'll play one clip later from that, just as an audio clip for the audience. And then I'll ask a question coming out of the clip, okay? So if we could just roll the clip first.
There's a lot of academics and textbook socialists out there that have all these great ideas. And they've been talking about these fantastic ideas for generations. Hasn't really come to fruition. I can bring together as many workers as I can. And we're not gonna pull together $1 billion to start an assembly plant. I mean, it sounds great in theory, but the practical reality of it is, like, give me a break.
I'm sorry for the feedback on that. But, you know, when I was listening to you talking about that, I was wondering, you and many people in the union have grown up where the existential struggle is worker against employer. And has that changed? Is the existential struggle today nation against nation and having to have workers, industry, government figuring out strategies together if we're going to compete as a nation? Do unions play a different role now?
No. Look, I think we've always been a part of the discussion. And I think we need to be a broader part of discussions in the future. And here's what I mean. Look, work is changing, but the challenges, by and large, continue to exist. So the whole question of what companies do, how they react, their pendulums for hoarding their money as opposed to sharing it, the preoccupation by not playing by the rules, I will argue. And then what do governments do about it? So for example, you talked about company town, but you also talked about the media file. And you talked about Netflix and Google and Facebook. So here's companies that are making money hand over fist without contributing a dime. Here's companies that I will argue will take all of the information compiled by the conventional traditional news media and don't pay a nickel for it. So we've had about 250 to 300 local newspapers have closed in the last 10 years. But if the advertising, the digital advertising dollars that are all going to Google, Netflix, and Facebook, if that revenue was distributed from those that they stole the information from, then we'd have a much stronger media sector in this country today. So to me, you can't have a strong democracy in a country without a strong media. It doesn't make any sense. You need different voices. And look, I just think that there has to be an element of fairness. And that's why when I talk about the roles of unions, governments, we all have to get in the room, because there's a solution for journalism in this country. And it's about taxing those that are sucking up all the revenue dollars that don't pay for it.
I'm happy to say we've along with others who've been around our shattered mirror process, have had some success there in getting some of those, a labor tax credit, for instance, which is something with a group of 10 of us that Unifor was part of, people from industry, people from unions, others. There's more work to be done there. And some of it's actually in recommendation one of the shattered mirror, which I recommend to people, because I think its time is coming around now. I just want to switch into one area of change, which is in the auto industry, and particularly electric vehicles. And you've had a lot of activity yourself around this issue over the last number of months. I think at one point you said that you'll personally, purchase an electric vehicle when your members are actually making them. And I'm wondering, those recent Ford and Chrysler announcements, you think we're getting close to that point?
I think we are. I think if you take a look at the CAMI plant, they'll be building the EV600, which is passenger vehicles that'll be used by Purolator, Amazon. So the commercial vehicles, but I'm expecting that by 2023, 2024, EV vehicles will be rolling off the assembly line, 2026 probably in Oakville, before that, like I said, in Windsor. So yeah, I have zero interest in buying an electric vehicle made in any other country besides Canada. And the first electric vehicle I have will be made clearly by our members.
Will this be a different kind of work for those members? Do they have to reskill for this? I mean, there's fewer parts in an electric vehicle. Do we need both fewer workers, I suppose, and do we need workers to have new sets of skills?
Well, assembling a vehicle, those skills aren't going to really change much. I mean, that type of work will be the same, but there will be less jobs for sure. In a traditional ICE, internal combustible engine, you're looking at about 1,400 parts. If you're looking at a battery electric vehicles, you're looking at about 250 parts. So there will be significantly less. Like, for example, you're not going to need transmissions. You're not going to need cooling systems. You're not going to need, like I said, the batteries as opposed to your traditional in your transmissions. But there'll be other types of work, right? There's different types of components. You're going to have electrical drive units, inverters, converters, heating, cooling systems, all kinds of other different stuff. So it'll be a hodgepodge for sure. But like I said, there may be less jobs, but I'm more concerned if the companies don't invest. We were heading in the wrong direction in this country. We used to be number five in the world in auto assembly, number five. Right now we're 12 or 13. So this is an opportunity, frankly, to reboot. This is an opportunity. We negotiated about $6 billion worth of investments, of which the lion's share will be transitioning to electric vehicles. We are incredibly concerned because up until bargaining last year, the global automakers had announced over $300 billion in EV investments and not one nickel in Canada. So that has changed. It changed in a significant way. And like they say, if they build it, if you build it, they will come. I never did buy that Field of Dreams argument. But I do believe it when it comes to the auto industry, because if you have an assembly plant that's going to be around, the auto parts suppliers come.
Okay, well, I guess that's what I'm trying to get a little bit in this Team Canada and working together approach. And clearly in the NAFTA negotiations, that's the kind of approach that you had to take. So what will it take to have, I'm going to say, an auto pack too, for the new auto industry?
Well, first of all, we have to keep an eye. I'm not too sure if we're going to be heading back to the auto pack. I would certainly be in favor of it. I have no idea how the WTO can strike down something like that. I think it's ridiculous. But anyway, I think it's about fairness. But what I'm concerned about, frankly, is what Biden is talking about doing, or what they may do. I'm concerned about some of the positions he's taken on Buy America, the impact that they'll have on the Canadian auto industry. So I really think that it's a question of everybody getting in a room and start talking about this industry. If you look at the auto industry, it's if the border doesn't exist. We have some components that will cross the border 3, 4, 5 times before they get assembled on a vehicle. So unless you're expecting a major disruption in Canada or the United States, I would suggest that can't change. And I don't expect it will. I'm concerned about some of the rhetoric that's coming out of the U.S., but Canada's going to have to be very strong and focused in how they deal with the Biden administration on this important industry, that's for sure.
Yeah, I always try to think of, what are our bargaining levers? I'm sure I don't think of it nearly as much as you do when you're in the kind of work that you do. And, a lot of people are talking about rare earths, critical minerals. Yep. Do we have electricity advantages in our clean electricity? So where do you see those levers and how do we apply them?
Well, you know what? You're dead on. I mean, we have been so content to be a branch plant economy. And we have, it's almost as if we have this, inferiority complex when it comes to the United States. Like, I just can't understand why we have always been so comfortable, being the drawers of water and hewers of wood. So here we are, a nation, surrounded, three coasts with water, rich in raw materials, natural, we got it all. Yet, as a nation, I will say we get an F as a grade for how it comes to developing our economy, because we always depend on others. Take a look at the pandemic. We couldn't even provide the most basic safety for ourselves. We couldn't even make a damn mask, personal protective equipment. Had no vaccines, nothing. Our entire safety was offshored, was offloaded, was outsourced, everything. So now we're sitting there taking a look at it and hopefully we're going, hey, hold on here. We have the ability, the technology, the whereabouts, the raw materials, natural resources. Why don't we use that to be the footprint of our economy? Why wouldn't we utilize our strengths? So in our dealings with the United States, if we're talking about the auto industry and we're talking about electric vehicles, what do we have that they want? Everything. Nickel, aluminum, lithium, magnesium, 4 of the major components for batteries. And we have it in abundance.
But we don't have a battery plant or any plans.
Oh, but we will. If I was a gambler, which I'm not, if there's one thing that the governments are talking about, I'm talking about the federal government, and frankly, I give Doug Ford, I don't give him much credit, but the reality is he's spending a lot of time talking about investing in a battery plant. So the governments understand that, look, if you want a long-term sustainable auto industry in this country, then you better build batteries. And they know that. And so they are very active, both levels of government. And I'm saying that quite emphatically and enthusiastically, because every time I speak to the different levels of government, whether it's the premier or the prime minister, they talk about doing everything they can to attract a battery manufacturer. Now, for example, I know Magna has the technology. They developed it and have it and had it in Europe. So if I take a look at Magna's, the Martin Rias, some of the more successful Canadian auto parts companies, it's just a question of getting everybody in a room and saying, look, we want this done. So how much is that going to cost? So I think we need to use our strengths. We can't back off to the United States. We can't say, oh, look, no problem. Like, you can continue hammering us with this over the softwood lumber dispute. You can talk about giving incentives for Americans to buy American-built vehicles. You can talk about all these other things, which will cause us grief here in Canada. And then at the same time, we just open the doors and say, take anything you want. There's going to have to be some hardball negotiations.
Yeah. Well, let's get that room together and get everybody in it. Right now, we have an even bigger room. And I want to go to some of the audience questions, because there's a lot of people here who, you know, want to hear from you on a variety of things. So first audience question here is, how can policymakers ensure reform don't hinder the success of gig workers and their ability to capitalize on flexibility and indeed independence? Is there a role for unions here? So this is a pro option of gig worker, which may not agree with, I don't know, we'll leave it to you, and a sense of, is there a role for unions with gig workers?
Well, it's interesting because there's no question there is a role for unions as it relates to gig workers. I'm thinking about, let me even back up. Let me go to the first part of the question. Look, there are a lot of gig workers that like the flexibility associated with it. But I will argue that all workers want good jobs. They want good full-time jobs. There are some people that like the flexibility, don't want to work 40 hours a week. But I will say that's the minority, not the majority. Because young people are no different than us. Young people, listen, I like the idea that when I started work in the manufacturing sector in the late 70s, that there was a very good chance that I was going to retire from that plant with a decent pension. And I'll say that young people today just want the same. They want a good paying job. This whole argument about, oh, they love the transparency, they love to bounce from one job to another job to another job to another job and have all that flexibility, that's BS. Young people today want good jobs, they want good pay, and they want to be able to provide for their families, which means a steady income over many years. So if you take a look at some of the gig workers that we're talking to, if we talk about Uber drivers, if you talk about, you know, there's different gig workers out there that we are talking to because they want a union. We have a freelancer section of our organization where we have people who are members who don't belong to your traditional workplace, yet still like the idea of being able to pool their resources. We have a lot of freelancers that, like I said, do work for the media sector, do freelance work in different sectors, but they still want a voice and they still want some leverage. So I will argue that gig workers are no different than anything else. We better find a way to incorporate them in the economy, because look, if you follow the pandemic, which we have, so many people started working from home. And in the beginning, wow, it was great. I don't have to get my butt out of bed, hop in the car and drive an hour through Toronto traffic to get to work. But here we are 15 months later and people view it as living from work. People want to get the heck out of the house. People need some mental stimulation. People like that work environment. They like to get out of the house. So there's a lot of discussions going on.
Okay, let me go to second question here from the audience. And I do have several. And I think it alludes perhaps to your comments earlier about not being afraid of technological change, wanting companies to invest in productivity improvements, I suppose. So it says, how should compensation and, you know, wages and compensation change to reflect ever-increasing productivity? And I guess that implies that productivity perhaps is not captured properly in wages.
Well, first of all, I believe in free collective bargaining. That's why I have a problem with the system in Mexico, where there's anything but free collective bargaining. I think that there's a definite need for, I will argue, more unionization. in society. It's not as if we're heading down a system or raw capital has proven. I will argue historically that, look, it's not many companies, and I'm generalizing now, but not many companies want to share. It's very much a question of extracting through collective bargaining. And like I said, I'm generalizing. There's a lot of good companies out there that, you know, take a look at their profitability and make sure they pay their workers accordingly based on their profitability. But I will argue that is not the norm. I will argue that, you know, the only real way in the ticket to that type of fairness is through free collective bargaining.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, you know, about upskilling, and they relate to each other, reskilling, upskilling. So, you know, one is very simply, what role do unions have in upskilling? And related to that is, have you seen any good examples of effective retraining for workers impacted by technology?
Okay, so unions, let me give an example. In Detroit 3 bargaining, we just negotiated advanced technology committees because the auto industry is changing quicker than anybody thought. And if we are going to deal with the changing technology, A, we want to know about it, but B, if our members see that the union leadership is not afraid with the changes and frankly is embracing it, it gives our members an element of comfort that, look, it can't be all that bad. Because generally, when you talk about new technology, people associate it with job loss. So for us, it's a real question of understanding what the technology is and then start to talk to our members about the necessity for training. So we like to be a part of it. We like to be the trainers. We like to be the ones that will deliver the training to our members. So when you're talking about upskilling, then we want to be a part of the process because I will argue it eliminates a lot of the uncertainty and fear. So like I've said many times throughout this conversation, I'm more afraid of companies that don't invest in those that do. Because yes, work will be different. If I take a look at the auto industry, I bet about 95% of all jobs will be impacted. And some will say there's going to be job loss as a result of it. And the answer is yes. But there will be different jobs created as a result of it as well. So it's a hodgepodge.
So 20 years ago or so, we had sector councils that had a role here, had a mandate. Is that a model that used to exist that would be good in future again?
Hold on, just let me, sorry about this for a second, Ed. Part of the last question too was, you know, different types of technology that has been a benefit. And look, workplaces today are much more ergonomically advanced. So some of the traditional heavy lifting that was done, and I can walk through a variety of different assembly plants, manufacturing facilities, even the way some of the service sector is done. So technology, I will argue, has taken away some of the real heavy lifting. I can give you a lot more other examples. Some, you know, in some manufacturing facilities, some of the jobs that were very unsafe have been replaced by robotics. So yes, it may have replaced some of the manual labor, but it created jobs to repair the robotics. So those are just some examples. Go ahead with your next question, Ed. Sorry about that.
That's interesting because it makes me think again about the skill sets that are required and how they change. And, you know, I recall now that you're speaking at the time that Oshawa was announced for closure in 2018, 2019. GM was hiring engineers at Markham, you know, maybe you could explain what they do at Markham for people. And I'm wondering if that kind of rebalancing of skills and education knowledge is going to be a continuing feature of the industry.
You know, it's interesting. When GM announced the engineering center in Markham, I'll never forget the big announcement. It was, Trudeau was there, Kathleen Wynne was there. Steve Carlisle was the head of GM Canada at the time, and I remember saying to Trudeau, you better make sure that they don't announce the opening of an engineering facility in Markham while at the same time looking to close Oshawa. So anyway, I kind of nailed that one. But the bottom line is what do they do there? I mean, it's one of the jewels of GM. For example, engineers there are on the leading edge of developing of autonomous vehicles. They really are talking about what the next generations are going to be be like, probably within the next 10 years, about 30 million cars around the globe will have 5G technology in it. So, you know, when you start looking at, you know, 5G technology, what it means as it relates to connectability, you know, when you think about a vehicle in the not so distant future, you know, when you talk about 5G, you're looking at about 50% of a vehicle will be computers. 50% of the cost of a car will be straight computers. So Markham is really on the leading edge of all of that. And I know that they put into place a test track in the back of Austin. So our argument always was, look, if you're going to have 1,000 engineers in Markham, and you're going to put a test track in Oshawott to test autonomous vehicles, why in the heck wouldn't you put workers back in Oshawott to build those vehicles, those autonomous vehicles? So obviously those are conversations we're going to be having with GM on an ongoing basis.
Okay, I'm going to have time maybe for one or two more audience questions, and I want to go back and play a last clip and ask you something off that. And I do have a question, an important question, particularly this week as Indigenous History Week, about the resources industry. And the question is, how can Canada ensure we honor our obligations to Indigenous peoples as we draw on our natural resources to become more self-sufficient? How do we ensure Indigenous self-determination is not undermined?
Well, it can't be. The bottom line is that Indigenous communities have to be a part of the discussion right from the beginning. And they can't be left behind. I mean, I have workplaces in Manitoba that are located in Indigenous communities. And if you look at the makeup of the workplace, maybe 5% of the workforce is made up of our members from the community. It's absolutely outrageous that we can have a workplace right in a community and yet only have 5% of the workforce reflected. Doesn't make any sense. As a matter of fact, it's embarrassing and it's insulting. So the discussion has to be had right from the beginning. And Indigenous communities have to be a part of the decisions, the discussions, and the solutions. And that doesn't happen by being excluded from the planning phase.
I'm going to go back to Company Town, and I do have a question here that strikes on it as I move into this clip, which is how do we redistribute wealth without companies leaving town? So does that become a threat? And how do we find that balance?
Well, first of all, I think governments have to be active in investments. I think governments have to play a role. It was interesting because one thing about the pandemic, I never saw so many entrepreneurs putting their hands out. I never saw and heard so many people that criticized governments, said, governments, keep away from me. We don't want any government involvement. You know, it's all about free enterprise and get out of the way, putting their hands out saying, please, I need some money. So boy, I never saw the most ardent conservatives become raging socialists overnight until the pandemic hit anyway. Just have a little fun, obviously. But look, there also has to be some discussions. I believe in governments playing a role. I believe in governments investing in the auto industry. I believe in governments investing in the aerospace industry. I believe governments playing an active role. But they also have to be able to say, and they also have to be able to bargain that says, if we're going to contribute to the job creation, then you're not going anywhere. So I think they have to be very specific as it relates to what expectations are. And I think consumers also have to be, I think, play an active role. I think companies that show absolutely no loyalty to Canadians, we should show no loyalty to them. So many companies will leave Canada and chase the dollar in third world countries because the workers can be exploited, yet they're free to dump their products in Canada and we happily buy them. So I think there has to be some social responsibility. I think we need to have those types of conversations. And one thing that happened, because Canadians are loyal, when GM announced that they were closing Oshawa back in 2018, GM went from number one in sales in Canada to number four. Canadians are loyal. And they watched and they thought it was unfair. How could GM be the number one selling, you know, number one in sales in Canada, and yet they're leaving? So Canadians took it personally. So I think there has to be a lot more of that as it relates to Canadian education on industry. Who does what, when, who's left, why? So I think it's a broader discussion, Ed.
I'm going to finish on one last point and roll this short clip of you and your father speaking. And for those who don't know your father, you're a second generation union leader in this country. Your father was involved in de Havilland Aircraft, involved in a famous strike at de Havilland, for which I think as a young teenager you made sandwiches, if I remember correctly. We're talking real human beings here. Policy always touches on real human beings. We're talking about workers and the impacts on them and the impacts on their representatives. So let me roll the clip and then ask you this question.
But do I feel good about it? No. Do I feel I let people down? Absolutely, because I did.
You shouldn't feel that way anyway.
Yeah, but I do. The bottom line is I do. People were expecting something better. My own niece and nephew, for crying out loud.
So leaving aside for a moment that the GM story has turned up now. But, you know, sometimes we live in a world, there's so much stress, there's so much change, there's so much unpredictability. There's not really a line between work disruption and personal psychological disruption and damage. So I just want to ask about this emotional toll about the future work. How will people bear it? How do you bear it?
I'm a bit of a different bird when it comes to pressure. I really, things bother me that I can control and I screw up, then I'm determined to fix it. But things that I can't control, I don't, you know, lose a ton of sleep over it. Now, the whole GM Oshawa was personal for me because my father lives in Oshawa, two of my sisters, niece and nephew. I got a lot of family in Oshawa. My mother's buried in Oshawa. So for me, it was personal. And we knew that it was a David versus Goliath sort of a situation. But frankly, losing wasn't an option, or having the plant closed wasn't an option. And when it became inevitable, I took it personally. It wasn't my decision. Did everything I could to change it, but I couldn't stop it. And so, you know, the earlier clip when I talked about, you know, look, basically, we don't live in a world of unicorns and rainbows. Like, I've got to be realistic as to what's doable and what's not. I mean, a lot of people are criticizing, saying we should have been pushing for employee ownership and all that other stuff. The bottom line is that doesn't work, not in a major industry where you need billions to invest just in technology, let alone in equipment. So, look, work is changing. And it's going to continue to change. But coming out of this, we have to be a part of the conversation or nothing's going to work properly. And I think that's the takeaway from today. The takeaway from today is that we need to have discussions as governments, as companies, as unions, as academia. We all have to get in the room and figure out what it's going to look like. And then when we understand what it looks like, then we can start to train people so that we are ready for the changing technology.
Right. And if we don't get that right, you're seeing manifest in mental health, you see it manifest in populist politics. Are those the prices of not getting it right?
It is the price of not getting it right. I mean, uncertainty is problematic for everybody. The uncertainty is tough on workers, but I'll argue uncertainty is tough on corporations as well. Because everybody likes an element of predictability in their life. And so we can do this if we do this thing together. It's when you have a collection of free agents that don't look and take into account the wants of others that we end up going down the wrong road.
Well, Jerry, I want to thank you so much for participating. I would like to thank you for your candor, but I think you have no control over it. I think it's embedded in your personality. So it's not willful. It's automatic. So I thank you for it. Nonetheless, and as I said to Andrew vis-a-vis TD, you know, PPF enjoys working with Unifor. It enjoys having diverse perspectives at our tables. And those who are intellectually interested in how we're going to make the future work are due to be commended. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the pleasure of being able to speak with you today. Thank you.
As you know, at this point in the podcast, we like to take a moment to highlight one of our members that has gone above and beyond the call of duty in terms of their ongoing contribution to a stronger and more resilient Canada. Our Brave New Work project, and by extension, this podcast, was made possible by many partners, including Cogeco, a leading Canadian telecom. Cogeco recently released a statement outlining their determination to reduce their environmental impact and implement best practices in order to exceed regulatory requirements. The digital transformation taking place at Cogeco allows and will continue to reduce the consumption of resources. Each year, they host a company-wide CSR Day, which is devoted to themes such as sustainable consumption, where the aim is to educate their employees about the social and environmental impacts of our daily activities. We are, as we say, PPF proud of Cogeco. And with that, this is a wrap on not only this episode of Policy Speaking, but the series until we're back in September. If you liked this episode, please leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. These reviews really help us be seen by other and new listeners and really amplify the messages that we're trying to share and the ones that you hopefully love so much. And to that end, make sure you share it with a friend or let us know your thoughts on Twitter at PPForumCA. I want to thank my colleagues at the Public Policy Forum who make this podcast happen, and thank Ed for handing over the reins to me today. And until September, I'm Katie Davey, and this has been Policy Speaking.